Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Stress test results, infidelity, resilience, and Pakistan turmoil this week. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner opened up his report card on the nation's banks. $75 billion needed to shore things up. He called it a good sign.
These actions today are going to bring an unprecedented level of transparency and clarity to the health of the nation's banking system.
Elizabeth Edwards, wife of former presidential hopeful John Edwards, opened up about her husband's now infamous affair. Oprah had the sit down.
You asked your husband for just one gift when you got married. What was that?
I wanted him to be faithful to me.
And a 500,000 displaced Pakistanis on the move as Pakistan's army moves on insurgents. Here, a Taliban commander says there's no backing down.
Taliban will stay in the area. They will give sacrifices if needed. We will sacrifice our life for Islam.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Is the bank report card bucking you up? Should it? What do you make of the Arlen Specter saga, the $17 billion in proposed budget cuts, Mrs. Edwards, Mr. Ramirez? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is David Leonhardt, writer for the New York Times Magazine and economics columnist for the Times. He interviewed President Obama for the magazine's cover story last weekend. David, great to have you back.
It's nice to be here.
With us from Washington, Perry Bacon Jr., national political reporter for The Washington Post. Perry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Perry.
David Leonhardt, first to you. You sat down very recently with the president on the economy. You're watching all these announcements come out this week on stress tests and unemployment. Are we turning a corner? Are we not? What do the signs tell us? How are they being interpreted, David?
I think we might actually be turning a corner. I'm going to add a lot of caveats to
okay.
that. But there are a few real reasons to think that this recession, this terrible recession, is moving to a new stage, and it's a better stage. Job losses increased essentially every month. The pace of job losses picked up essentially every month in the second half of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And they've slowed down essentially, not quite every month, but pretty clearly over the first 4 months of this year. So we had only 500 and something thousand jobs lost in April.
Only. It still sounds big.
It's big, and we should put quote marks around only. It's a terrible month. It's worse than any month that we had in either the 90-91 recession or the 2001 recession. But it's very clearly slowing. I mean, we lost almost 750,000 jobs in January. We lost between 600,000 and 700,000 jobs in February and March. And the history of recessions is that the same way we have a vicious cycle in which spending cuts lead to job cuts and then more spending cuts, there are also virtuous cycles in which people start to get a little bit more optimistic. And in the past, when job cuts have slowed, the recession has ended very soon afterwards, within a matter of months. The two big caveats are this is worse than an ordinary recession, and that raises the risks that we'll have something like a second leg down, much as the Great Depression did. The second is that the economy isn't going to feel good for most of us anytime soon. The idea that job cuts are slowing doesn't mean the unemployment rate will come down. It will probably go up into next year. It doesn't mean that we'll start to get big pay increases. And so while you need to have the economy turn before it can feel good, the fact that it's starting to turn, or seems to be, doesn't mean that the economy will feel good really even any time this year.
We'll talk about the stress test and the bank, but Perry Bacon, you're in Washington as well. I mean, the politicians there, you know, always smelling the wind. Do you sense political Washington sensing that we may be turning a corner on this thing? Is it changing the conversation, or does it feel like spin, even happy talk?
I think it's somewhere in between those two things. I think the Obama administration has been is trying to give some signs. They feel like the economy. You saw Gary Geithner's remarks this week that they feel like the economy is improving and going in the right direction. But I think both on Capitol Hill and with the Obama administration, they're very wary of saying we've had a turnaround, especially with the numbers today, with the unemployment rate going up again. I mean, I know that job loss is slowing some, but it's still going up. So I think people on Capitol Hill are particularly wary of saying, you know, we turned a corner already.
Jack, you know, there's such a psychological element to this. You know, been down so long, it looks like up to me. I mean, in a way, the whole country wants to see good news here. David Leonhardt says we may indeed have some. But you wonder, you know, is there another leg down? Are we just longing to feel better? And so we will. Is the no mean antenna president picking up on that?
Yes. And is the corner we've turned the corner into an L-shaped recovery? You know, the IMF has observed that the recoveries following financial crises are typically slower than in other sorts of downturns. And, of course, we have the classic case of Japan, which had an L-shaped recovery that seemed to go on for a decade of just anemic growth. And, yeah, so you could technically have the recession is over, and how can you tell?
Ben Bernanke was talking before Congress this week, and he said he doesn't think the jobless rate will go on to hit double digits, talking kind of optimistically.
We think that the unemployment rate will probably peak early in 2010 and then come down relatively slowly after that. Currently, we don't think it's going to get to 10%. We're somewhere in the nines, but clearly that's way too high.
That's turning a corner language. Here's Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner yesterday talking as the administration released the results of the famous bank stress tests.
Steps taken already, again, by the administration, working with the Congress alongside the Federal Reserve and the FDIC, have helped bring interest rates down, help reduce credit spreads, help open lending markets a bit. Things are improving in financial markets, but we have a long way to go.
Improving, long way to go. David Leonhardt, I have to admit, I don't really know how to interpret what I see, what we all see in these numbers. They may need $75 billion more. From where? They may lose, another $599 billion next year if things don't go well. How bad is that? Out of the woods or teetering or, you know, what?
I would say getting a little better, not going to feel any good anytime soon, and still facing real risks. That the progress we've made may all disappear and things will get worse again. I think those are the three main points, and they are, as you point out, somewhat contradictory. The question about where are we going to get the $75 billion, that's the number that the Federal Reserve and the administration puts on the amount of additional capital that the biggest banks need in order to be healthy enough to lend to businesses and households. If they are right about that number, that is a completely manageable number. The TARP, the bailout fund that the Bush administration and Congress approved late in 2008, still has $100-something billion left in it. So if the Obama administration is not being too rosy, and if $75 billion is really the right number, they've got that money. The worry is that if it is $200 or $300 or $400 or more billion, then they have to go back to Congress and ask for more money. And there are sort of two different political analyses of that. One is that they're going to look bad because their initial optimism will not have come to fruition, and they will essentially have to say, sorry, guys, we were wrong. Give us some more money for those evil bankers. Mm. The other is that they can then say, look, we tried everything. We really wanted to avoid doing this, but the situation is what it is, and we need more money.
Now, half the banks said to be in trouble and half in not so much trouble. Does a changed banking system emerge from this after the crisis we've just come through? Or is this putting things back up on the same wheels?
I certainly hope so. I mean, if you look at the amount of leverage that our financial system took on, and that just means debt, right? How much debt they took out relative to their assets, relative to the capital, the money that they held, they were far, far too leveraged, a little bit like American households. They were even more leveraged, much more leveraged than American households. And what that allowed Wall Street to do was to make a lot of money in the short term. Because if you take out a loan and then invest it and the investment starts to go up, you actually do much, much better than you would if you didn't take the loan out. You're borrowing money, betting more of it, and you get to keep the whole return. But once the situation reverses and prices start going down, you lose all your money. Anyone who put a 20% down payment on their house and has seen their house go down by 20% in value and now has nothing understands this in a very fundamental way. Wall Street should not be so leveraged. It led to massive pay on Wall Street. It didn't really contribute as much to the economy as people once thought. And so I really hope for the sake of the economy that we're going to see a financial system that is allowed to have less leverage and is thus smaller.
Perry Bacon, do you have the sense in Washington of the teeth being in what Obama is preparing here that will actually bring us a changed system? Nouriel Roubini and Matthew Richardson writing this week, we should have let some of these banks go bankrupt. That's the way you put the real market discipline into a system. Again, instead, we've got bailouts, maybe more to come here. Do you see the actual nuts and bolts of change emerging, Perry?
There's been some talk on Capitol Hill already in the administration about sort of re-changing the regulations and how Wall Street is regulated. And I think there's a lot of talk about that, and I think it will happen over the next year. This is a process that'll probably happen after healthcare reform. It'll happen at the same time. I mean, Obama's first priority right now is sort of healthcare reform and the banks and really sort of reducing the unemployment rate. But I think along with that, it will come some new regulations over the next year.
How about it, Jack? Do you see the troops marshaled to come out with a different arrangement than the one that brought us to this pass?
Well, I dearly like to see the troops in the Justice Department marshaled. I mean, if these firms are too big to fail, and if they're so big that they're tempted into this dangerous sort of leverage that David was talking about, isn't it time that they become smaller? And shouldn't that be? Isn't that in the public interest? And I haven't yet heard that antitrust approach taken by the administration, and I'm wondering if that will be something we're going to be hearing about.
Do we need that, David, antitrust, or will they be broken up just selling off chunks of themselves to raise the money they're said to need here?
There are a few different ways to do it. I think antitrust is an important part of it. I think also the thing that I'm really going to want to watch is once the Treasury Department and the Fed come out with these new regulations, how hard are they on things like leverage, and how do they deal with the pushback that they're going to get inevitably from Wall Street? Wall Street is not going to say, we're really sorry about that whole financial crisis we caused. We don't want to go back to having lots of leverage and making lots of money. Mm. That won't happen. Wall Street will fight to preserve a lot of what it had before. And some of what it had before is good. Some of it does lead to better functioning financial markets, but much of it doesn't. And I really hope the Fed and the administration stand up to the industry on this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news, stress tests, job losses, Pakistan, Elizabeth Edwards, Manny Ramirez. David Leonhardt joins us from the New York Times, sat down very recently with President Obama, had his big story in the New York Times Magazine on the economy and the president's outlook last week. Perry Bacon Jr. joins us from Washington, D.C., national political reporter for the Washington Post, and Jack Beatty's here. President Obama talking a lot this week about budget cuts. He wants to take $17 billion out of that federal budget. Of course, it's much bigger than that. Here he is announcing that he would try to slash line items in the budget.
These savings, large and small, add up. The 121 budget cuts we are announcing today will save taxpayers nearly $17 billion next year alone. And even by Washington standards, that should be considered real money.
House Minority Leader John Boehner, Republican, Ohio, said at a news conference that those budget cuts were not deep enough. He'd do better.
We're working on real cuts that will save real money and bring down the size of the deficit. And over the next couple of weeks, you'll have a chance to see what real budget cuts look like.
Perry Bacon, everybody's talking cuts, but what's really going on is a lot of spending. But what about the $17 billion? Can Obama get it from his own government, his own party?
No, it looks like this is the answer what we've seen so far. I think almost every cut he proposed in the last few days has been opposed by some member of Congress, most of whom have been Democrats. I think that the $17 million number will be hard to get to when the appropriations process is over. This is a perpetual problem in Washington. Everyone who's president comes here and says they're going to reduce wasteful spending, but everyone's definition of wasteful spending is varies depending on where you're sitting. I mean, there's some, like, he's trying to cut farm subsidies. I've been talking about that for a while, but there are a lot of senators and members of Congress from rural areas who really don't like that. He's tried to cut some Head Start programs that he argues are not effective, and some of the other members of Congress say they are effective. I think it's going to be really difficult to cut this money. And of course, the budget is $3.4 trillion, too, so we really are talking. I know he said this is real money, but not so much.
Jack Beatty, $3.4 trillion budget. The Democrats run Washington now. Is $17 billion too much to ask? In cuts?
You wouldn't think so, but of course, all politics is local, and each of those programs has constituents, and those constituents have people in Congress, and with a political system that is as uncompetitive as ours, what incentive do Congress people have to go along with the president? Not much. And the question with I think the president is, will he, as time goes on, stand up against people in his own party? I've got some thoughts about that. But, I mean, here, just on cuts, it would be very nice to see him come out and name names, people who are holding up, who won't go along with it, and often for reasons of parochial, the most parochial kind of politics.
But isn't this key for Obama? If he's to keep the country's confidence, he's asked the country to spend very big to get out of, to avoid what maybe could have been a depression. And part of the promise there was, you know, as we do this, we're also going to look for cuts, and we will make those cuts to pull back from this. If you can't do $17 billion out of all those trillions, how much credibility does the president have?
Much less. Thus far, he's big on spending and big on rhetoric of cutting and no examples of it. Now, I think we're going to hear a lot as the summer goes on about entitlement reform. And Social Security recipients and people on Medicare, I think, have got to worry about what that's going to mean. But on the other hand, if they can't make headway on this kind of picayune, 1.5% of the budget cuts, what are they going to do when it comes to Medicare and Social Security?
David Leonhardt, from an economic perspective, big picture, is this a tempest in a teapot, or is it an important sign to lenders, investors, about where that overall federal budget deficit goes forward if $17 billion runs into trouble?
In the end, I think it's going to all be about health care. If they can reduce the growth of healthcare costs, the $17 billion won't matter at all. But the fact that Congress, both parties, Democrats and Republicans, have been so uninterested in budget discipline. I thought the segment you just played from Minority Leader Boehner was telling, because he said, we'll come out with our list of cuts later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what Congress has been saying. They oppose any sort of reduction in subsidy, and then they say, we'll come out with our ideas later on for balancing the budget. Congress so far really has shown almost no interest in this fiscal discipline issue. Obama is not realistic about fiscal discipline, but Congress is a lot less realistic. And so the question is, what's going to happen to healthcare? That is something approaching all of the long-term budget problem. And so if we can figure out a way to bring down our healthcare costs and do less of the healthcare spending that doesn't actually make people healthier and try to get rid of some of the subsidies that are in there, the $17 billion won't matter. But if this turns out to be a sign of what's to come, and we're going to have Congress members defending each little healthcare program because it benefits some employer in their district, even if it hurts the country as a whole, we're going to have problems.
Perry, let's go to the really big game then, healthcare. If it's hard to marshal on $17 billion, what about the bigger reform here? Do you see President Obama lining up his ducks in Congress to actually make this happen? Are the Democrats with him? Can the Republicans stop it if they are? Is there anything like a force moving forward in an organized way on this? Can you tell?
Yes, I think some of the members of Congress this week have been talking about the fact they want to push, particularly some of the moderates, they would rather see Obama push health care reform than the sort of global warming climate change bill that's also sort of moving simultaneously. So there is a big push on health care. I think it depends. The key question will be looking at the details. I think David mentioned the fact that, you know, Obama wants to find some way, some savings in health care, which is going to be controversial. The other big question is a lot of the Democrats are pushing very hard for what's called a public plan, essentially the notion that there will be a Medicare like option you can enroll in the new health insurance regime, in addition to the private insurers getting it from Kaiser or the kind of private company. That's become a big flashpoint. Obama wants to work with some Republicans on health care reform, but that's become a big flashpoint for them. It also has some implications for costs, which could worry some moderate Democrats as well. So we've gotten into the health care reform is the big push of the year for Obama, but the question is, how do they get that done and what do the details look like is still sort of being discussed up here a lot.
Jack, do you see the Dems lined up to do it? Obama's team?
I think you're seeing some resistance from the Senate up and down the line on this and on other matters. And I would group it under the rubric of the politics of inequality. You know, David, in his wonderful interviews with Obama, has pointed out how the president really wants to rebalance our social political system so that people toward the bottom and in the middle get a better break on taxes, better break on jobs through education spending and so on. But what we have, of course, is the status quo that is really a status quo built around this politics of inequality. And consider things that have been happening in the Senate recently, crucial to the president's plan to keep straitened homeowners in their houses. It was a bill to allow bankruptcy judges flexibility in resetting mortgage rates. The banks were against it last week. The Senate defeated it with 12 Democrats joining all the Republicans. Quote, the banks own the Senate, Senator Durbin commented. Two, this week, the president outlined a plan to close tax loopholes on U.S. corporations using offshore tax havens. Senator Max Baucus, Democratic chair of the Finance Committee, demurred, saying the plan needs further study. Of course, it's been on the boards for years, and the president campaigned on it. Three, the president campaigned on reforming the estate tax. He would have allowed couples to claim a $7 million exemption before it clicked in. Wasn't generous enough for Blanche Lincoln, the Arkansas Democrat, or 11 other Democrats who voted last month to increase the exemption to $10 million, which I got to tell you, Tom, was a big relief to Lois and me. Four, right. President Obama campaigned on introducing the public plan, as Perry said. Ben Nelson, the Nebraska Democrat, has declared war on it. Why? It would hurt private insurance companies. Finally, the president, his budget included a provision that would limit charitable deductions enjoyed by affluent taxpayers. Essentially, it would return the deduction to what it was under that Bolshevik Ronald Reagan. Kent Conrad, the Democratic chairman of the Budget Committee, stripped the tax out of the budget. You know, it would have paid for health care for the uninsured, precisely the kind of rebalancing of the tax code to mitigate inequality that Obama campaigned on and talked to David about.
Sounds like political troops out of line. We'll come to you, Perry Bacon, on that. Let's get a call here from New Britain, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. You know, while we're on the subject of Max Baucus, he held the first of the congressional roundtables on this insurance issue on health care reform. And the insurance industry was represented, HMOs were represented, the pharmaceutical industry was represented. Who wasn't represented? Single-payer health care advocates. They asked to be invited. They were refused an invitation. When the single-payer healthcare advocates showed up, these are doctors in support of a single-payer program, they were thrown out and some of them were arrested just for asking for a seat at the table in these ongoing talks. I'd like to hear the panel's opinion of that.
Perry Bacon, what do you say to that?
The president actually met last week with a bunch of more liberal members of Congress, John Conyers, Dennis Kucinich, some others. They're called the Progressive Caucus. Mm. And in that meeting, they actually asked him to start, you know, really consider single payer, and he told them no, which is something he's been saying throughout. The problem is that people tend to agree, the people who work in the health insurance experts, more or less, their view is that the first thing most Americans who vote already have health insurance. So the one thing you want to make sure you do, and no matter how you change a system, is to not change it that much for people who already have insurance. Some of the people like their insurance. You don't want to have you don't want to create any major changes with people who already have insurance. So therefore, every health insurance reform is going to start with you do no harm and don't do anything radical, and single payer to a lot of, you know, would result in a lot of ads from Republicans that Democrats are very wary of. So I think single payer is probably off the table, and I'm not surprised that Baucus is not really thinking about it.
So the politics kick in again. Let's go to Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. First, thanks to Jack Beatty for mentioning the thing with Dick Durbin. That whole fiasco is very demoralizing to me.
On foreclosure regulations.
Well, yeah. I mean, like a couple of years ago, they changed the bankruptcy law so that people who wanted to file Chapter 7 had to go into Chapter 13. And now all these people that were forced into Chapter 13 are losing their houses, and this would have just allowed the judges just a little leeway to cram down what they owe. And the Congress, not the Senate actually, totally caved in on it. And it speaks really volumes to the fact that the average person just doesn't have a chance, really doesn't have a chance. You know, the previous caller talked about single payer. It's overwhelmingly popular in the electorate. There's just, you know, poll after poll shows that people are in favor of this. The government really just doesn't respond to the needs of the people.
David Leonhardt, how about it on the front of housing and foreclosure and bankruptcy? And, you know, Dick Durbin took his step. Is that the power of banks back at the table, calling the tune there, or something else, David?
It is the power of banks. I just read Master of the Senate, Robert Caro's wonderful third volume biography of Lyndon Johnson, which is really, it's a history of the Senate, and I recommend it highly. President Obama read it, actually, after he became a senator. And it is, it's a fabulous history of the Senate. Much of it focused on civil rights. But this is the history of the Senate. I mean, the Senate for a long time has been doing things like representing the interests of the financial industry. There are some amazing cartoons that you would see from the 1920s that would feel very familiar to the cram-down fight. I'm very sympathetic to the argument that this legislation should have passed. I mean, the fact is judges already have the power to rewrite the terms of mortgages on vacation homes. So it makes a lot of sense that they should have it to rewrite the terms on first homes. I don't think the politics, though, are a slam dunk on this because the fact is most people in this country didn't take out mortgages they couldn't afford. Most people bought homes they could afford. And although a lot of people bought homes they couldn't afford, it is still a minority. And it's a relatively small minority. And so I think a lot of people have mixed feelings about this. On the one hand, they have sympathy for people who got themselves into a bad situation. On the other hand, they feel like, well, I don't need help. I wasn't irresponsible. And I think that tension is one of the reasons why the politics of this aren't so clear-cut. And while on the one hand, you have the banks vigorously opposing this, and on the other hand, you don't have a mass of people, a majority or anything like it, who would benefit from this legislation. And I think that's part of the reason it didn't pass.
There's some real politic, even in an administration that came in on the theme of change. Let's get a call from Columbia, South Carolina. Marilyn, you're on the air. Hi, Marilyn. Are you there? Well, Marilyn may be off and running. Let's go. We've got another caller from Columbia, South Carolina. JP. JP, you're on the air.
I would like to weigh in on Mrs. Edwards outgoing Oprah and her book.
Yes.
I really feel sorry for her because she's got a lot of problems. But it kind of seems that there might be some method to her madness because they've been out of the political spotlight since the John's problems, and they may be trying to make a comeback. She's very political and has, you know, run his political campaign before.
That sounds like a pretty rugged way to come back, though, doesn't it, with this sort of full open kimono on infidelity and pain inside the family? It hardly looks like a great... I mean, do you really think there's room for a comeback with that as a base?
Well, it gets you back into the limelight. I mean, you know, what comes next is going to be the telltale sign.
Let's listen to Elizabeth Edwards right here on Oprah talking about her husband's affair. And among other things, Oprah pressed her on maybe the toughest subject.
The other woman has a baby.
That's what I understand.
And there is great speculation that your husband, John Edwards, is the father of that baby.
Right. That's what I understand. I've seen a picture of the baby. I have no idea. It doesn't look like my children, but I don't have any idea.
Jack Beatty, they say no publicity is bad publicity, but this looks agonizing to me. How do you read it?
Oh, I just don't know what to say. I mean, you know, I first heard of John Edwards from a colleague who talked about seeing him campaigning in Iowa. And he went before an Iowa group, and he made an anti-trade speech and talked about, you know, the shame of American jobs being exported abroad and we have to do things and keep the jobs here and so on. And when he came off the stage, someone said to him, but John, you're a free trader and your whole record is free trade. And he said, yeah, but they don't know that, meaning the people in the audience. Oh, this guy, that goes to his political character. This guy has always been a very dubious quantity, I think.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Towering inferno on the West Coast this week, troubles for Manny, and a new face, a transplant, speaks up in Ohio. Wildfires rage around Santa Barbara, many homes lost, and hope against hope here.
This is where I grew up. This is my childhood home, and I don't want to see it destroyed. My folks put way too much time and love and energy into this to see it all, you know, turn to ash.
And yet many did. Dodgers star outfielder Manny Ramirez tested positive for a banned substance, suspended for 50 games. His manager, Joe Torre, shook his head.
You know, the worst thing I think a person can be is a disappointment to somebody else, and Manny feels like a disappointment.
And Connie Culp, the first successful face transplant in America, spoke out with a little humor. She was asked if her doctor gave her what she'd hoped for.
He did what he said. I got me a nose.
We're looking at stress test, job loss, Pakistan, Edwards' Manny Ramirez. Let's go to Stephen in New York City. Stephen, you're on the air with David Liebenhardt, Perry Bacon, and Jack Beatty.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty well.
You know, I wanted to make a couple of comments. First of all, you said politics is still going. Of course politics is still ongoing.
Sure.
Politics isn't static. But that was not my most important point. I think that your concern about the bankruptcy law that didn't get through the Senate and this sort of, I think, over-anxiety about how the Senate is in the pocket of the banks, this isn't so. In a practical sense, if you give judges that type of authority, there is no real objective standard. Mm. So every judge is going to make his own decision. Then you have inconsistency, which undermines the rule of law. So you can't have it both ways.
Tom, can I ask the caller a question?
Yeah, yes. Is that Perry?
No, it's David.
David, yeah, please. Go for it. Stephen.
I just like the caller's thoughts on the fact that the judges already have this authority for second homes, for vacation homes. And so if that's okay, should we be getting rid of that as well? Or do you think there's a reason why we can't extend it to first homes as well?
What do you say, Stephen? All right for the cushy crowd who's got a second home to kind of have a little, you know, warm shoulder?
It's all about mean-spirited conservatives. No, look, I don't know. What are the provisions for second homes?
The provisions are that the judges can do precisely what the bill would have done for first homes. The cram down exists for second vacation homes.
That's not specific enough. What are the provisions for second homes? You keep referring to them. What are the provisions? Do they have absolute authority to do whatever they want vis-a-vis second homes?
That they can rewrite the terms of them the same way they could have with this bill. I don't think this is the result of mean-spirited conservatives. I didn't say that at all. I mean, as we pointed out, this was a bipartisan move. But it seems to me that if you're going to argue that this represents some sort of qualitatively new legal precedent, you got to grapple with the fact that it already exists for other loans.
Let's hear on the same subject from thank you, Stephen, for calling. Let's hear from Chris in Vernon, Connecticut.
Hi.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I would just like to comment on a couple of points that one of your commentators there was making earlier and saying at one point he said, well, okay, the economists don't want to rock the boat because the majority of Americans already have insurance, and they don't want to lose what they have.
Yeah.
And the other comment he made was on, they don't want single payer. Well, as another phone caller pointed out, poll after poll indicates that that is not true. While we middle class may have insurance, that doesn't mean we're not having trouble paying for it, continuing to pay for it, and continuing to be rejected when we go to ask for certain types of health coverage or whatever, and that we don't want single payer. The other point that I wanted to make was that he was talking about how the middle class didn't, you know, the majority of Americans bought houses that they could afford, and they don't want help. Well, that's patently untrue. The majority of middle-class people who could afford their mortgages and their houses do want help because we are drowning with all of these additional things. So it's not necessarily that, you know, Congress is not in tune with the average person. that they live in a different world up there in their ivory tower or whatever you want to call it. And I just wanted to point that out.
Chris, we've got it. And let me get one more on this neck of the woods from Royal Oak, Michigan. Sabrina, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, I was listening to the show, and I heard a lot of good things about homes and health insurance, and we are one of the people who carry part of our insurance through my husband's employer. They pay half, and we pay half.
Half.
And that's like over $7,000 a year, and that puts us in debt that much money every year to carry it. And so, you know, we can't afford to keep carrying this high insurance. When my husband first was employed by this company, it was like $15 a month, and now it's over $600. So with this Obama plan, we really can't afford to lose our insurance, but we can't afford to keep paying for it either, because it's going to cost us to lose our house, because my husband also has had pay cuts, like everybody else, days
sure.
off with no pay.
Yep.
And, you know, I live in Michigan. We've been in the ditch for the past 7 years. And I hear things like people are saying, oh, well, we're producing things in this country. We just need to export more of them. And I'm thinking, well, what are we exporting? I mean, because we're not making anything. So there's, you know, a lot of smorgasbord that you have on there, but I'm not sure what the answers are. And it doesn't seem like one of the callers said, that the American people aren't really getting their concerns addressed. And I had an issue with a bank where Chase Bank gave me a 1.99% interest rate, and then they went and jacked it up to 12%, and they said, well, they have to compete in this economy. And I saw on TV that they're one of the banks passing the stress test, J.P. Morgan, and I suspect, you know, that this is one of the reasons is that they're sticking it to the consumer, and the consumer's getting no relief anywhere.
Sabrina, you've given us a lot back right there, and thank you for it. Perry Bacon, I mean, that sounds like the sound of shifting politics to me. Of course, Michigan's got it hard, but a lot of places have it hard right now. Another 500,000 jobs lost. That's fewer than before, fewer than the 700,000 plus in January. But there's a lot of tough times, and maybe shifting politics out there with that. Obama must be watching. Congressman must be listening.
Yes. I mean, I think there are two things that are interesting right now is that Obama's approval rating remains really high and has increased in some polls, and also the unemployment rate has increased continually over the last few months. Those things are not going to remain true for the next 2 to 4 years. I mean, I think for him, and you can see everything he's doing is targeted in terms of like helping the economy, A, and also B, helping with the sort of inequality and the problems of people who can't afford health insurance, can't afford to buy a home, can't afford to pay their mortgage. This is his whole first term has been, this whole first year has been very focused on these issues, and members of Congress are debating those same issues. They're hearing that back home as well. I mean, the devil gets into the details on some level. I think one of the callers mentioned what I did, which is that he talked about the support for single payer. Mm. Yes, and yes, people do in polls seem to support single payer. I'm not sure what that means if we actually had a bill. I think that might change if we actually got a bill to the floor that said that was about single payer. And I think that also politicians assume from the 93-94 experience sort of really radical health care reform is hard to do. But I think there's a lot of interest in seeing health reform fixed this year, and that's why I think Obama's going to push really hard. He's already brought in members of Congress in the last few weeks and sort of really pushed the chairman to say, we need to get this timeline going. We need to make sure this happens by the end of the year.
Jack, Obama's approval rating still very high indeed, but here's another comment off Twitter from Jason. It says, Barack's theme of change has come true. Change is all we will have left in our pockets when he's done.
Oh, boy, that's a good
Ouch.
One. That's a good one. And, you know, it isn't change that's standing in the way, really, on Capitol Hill. It's big money. I mean, the question to me about the Obama plan is whether it's possible to get fundamental reform in our system without sweeping campaign finance reform, without essentially public paying for elections. I'm dubious that it can be done. I mean, you would think that right now senators and representatives would be going out of their way to show the people that they really get their pain and that they're really going to put their interests first. But that's not how it works. They really put their own interests first. And, you know, the best book about the Clinton healthcare fiasco was called The Sound of Money. And the sound of money drowned out the sound of voters, like that woman from Michigan. The Congress doesn't hear it. It doesn't hear her voice when the money speaks louder. And with the money in politics, any chance of reform is very narrow indeed.
We've got to have an economy that's working. healthcare that's working, but everybody in on those. Let's go to Fred to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Fred, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm a realtor in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. On this idea of cram downs, allowing judges to be able to tear up mortgage contracts, it's not the good idea that it seems to be for this reason. When lenders know that their principal can be reduced, mm-hmm. they will charge a higher risk premium, so the interest rates will be higher. And that's why second home loans have higher interest rates. It's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons, because in making a vacation loan, the lender has to factor in that fact that in a bankruptcy, the amount can be reduced.
So be careful what you wish for. If you've got that cram down option for first mortgages, first homes, you think you'll see higher interest rates on those homes.
Well, exactly, and that means that people who are responsible in paying their mortgages would be paying higher interest rates to pay for those who are not responsible and go into bankruptcy.
David Leonhardt, there's the economic argument from a realtor on the front line. What do you say?
I think it's a very fair argument. I mean, this is an issue of balancing pluses and minuses, and that is the big minus of the so-called cram down bill. When I look at it all, I don't think interest rates would actually go up that much from it. And so to me, the benefits of cram down seem to outweigh the costs. But I think it's entirely reasonable if you want to argue the other way. In a way, that's the economic version of the political point I was trying to make before, mm-hmm. which is that there's some concern here that this is helping the minority, people who didn't pay their homes or right. who won't in the future, at the expense of the majority, people who will. And so I really do think that the interests of the financial industry are a big reason this got defeated. But this argument is a serious argument, and it's also part of what's going on.
What about the housing market generally, David? Do you see a revival there? People still talking about it could chunk down another 20% or so. Can we get this economic turnaround that administration people are talking about now if housing still has that potential downside to it? Or is the return there too?
I think housing still has a ways to go down. If you look at it nationally, we are very close now to the historical relationship between home prices and incomes, or home prices and rents. Maybe we're 5%, 10% away nationwide. But we are likely to overshoot on the downside the same way we overshot on the upside because of the glut of unsold and in many cases, foreclosed homes. And the fact that nationally we're not that far away from housing's fundamental value doesn't mean that regionally there aren't still some big drops to come. New York still, home prices still seem to be well too high. They still seem to be too high in Miami, amazingly enough, even though they've fallen almost in half. And so I think housing still has a ways to go down.
Let's go to Al in Sterling, Massachusetts. Al, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Very briefly, no one seems to be standing up or hearing for those of us in the middle class who have responsibly paid mortgages for responsible-sized homes for 10 and 15 and 20 years. I'm 20 years into a mortgage on a $150,000 home. It's only about 14,000 square feet in area. It's plenty adequate for a husband and a wife and two kids. And now everyone's going to get this cram down on homes that they didn't deserve, and there's nothing for us out there. In fact, it's going to come out of our pockets. As people have just said, us responsible people, and no one anywhere is hearing this or reading this in any of this mortgage stuff.
Al, I hear you loud and clear there.
Well,
Jack?
Yeah, well, Al, according to Elizabeth Warren, the bankruptcy expert at Harvard and who also is heading a committee on Congress looking into this, 800,000 homes since the last 3 months have received foreclosure-related notices. Now, the value of your home is tied up with the value of these foreclosed homes. If foreclosures go on, and if they happen in your area, that's a drug on the market that brings down the value of your home. Just on self-interest grounds, it seems to me, there's a case to be made that yes, maybe it allows some people who are irresponsible to get a better break, but if it keeps everybody's values from falling, isn't that a good thing?
We're not going to settle that one today, Al, but I appreciate your call. Perry Baker, and turn with us for just a second, if you would, to Afghanistan and Pakistan. This bombing, apparently U.S. military hitting civilians, some debate about what actually happened there, but it appears some role in those bombs. And, of course, the two presidents in Washington this week and all kinds of trouble in Pakistan this week. Light in the tunnel there, Perry? What's the word in Washington?
This has become the biggest issue for Obama, and less Iraq and more Afghanistan and Pakistan. You see he's trying to work through that. Congress just passed a bunch of money this week that very reluctantly, but a lot of the Democrats see this as a war without end. They're making the same kind of comments they were making about Iraq, about Afghanistan, but next week they're going to pass money that'll allow him to increase the number of troops there and also to keep that fight, the war going on there. But I think there's a lot of concern about what's going on there on Capitol Hill.
Jack, our time grows short, but we've seen those pictures, maybe 500,000 displaced people on the move in Pakistan, the army revving up there, but no clear sign of whether or not it's really going to take the Taliban on effectively. This is as tough as it gets.
It is, and you know, the question is the United States taking the threat of the Taliban more seriously than the Pakistani government? You know, this week, David Obie, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the House, really made quite a parallel. He said, when I came here in 1969, I was opposed to the Vietnam War, but President Nixon pointed out that he had inherited it and deserved some time to try and make his policy work, so I decided to keep my mouth shut for a year. At the end of the year, he hadn't moved the policy, so I began to oppose the war. And he's saying to Obama, I may do the same with you.
And Jack, here's another Twitter message from Abba. Says, Red Sox fan says, we dodged a bullet twice. First A-Rod, now Manny. Holy smokes. Manny out for 50 games at the Dodgers, Jack.
Letting Manny be Manny is suddenly taking on a whole new dimension of meaning here.
What kind of Manny have we got here?
That's right.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Interesting week in the news. David Leonhardt at the New York Times. Always great to talk with you, David. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to be on.
And Perry Bacon Jr. at the Washington Post. You're great. And thank you very much for joining us today, Perry.
Thank you for having me.
Jack, have a great weekend, sir.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.